Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive. And we're waiting for our guest, Brother Imam Yusuf Abdul Salam, to come to the mic. While we are waiting for him to come to the mic, I would like to announce that we will have an all-men's meeting in the city of Linden, New Jersey, and I'm now looking for the address. It will be held at the Entrepreneur and Business Center, 710 West St. George Avenue in Linden, New Jersey. Vending space is available. Contact 908-463-4843, or you can contact Adib Shaka, 973-420-4172. Father, Son, Men, and Boys. We're going to have an all-men's meeting at 1 o'clock, a general meeting, public address. That's the 5th of November in the city of Linden, New Jersey. And our public address will be Taking Back Our Community. Major address. I'm also going to be addressing the upcoming election, and we're going to have a march called Taking Back Our Community. Brother Imam, welcome to Religion Means Alive.
It's good to be here, and peace be unto you, my brother. How are you doing this evening?
I came from 4 hours of retail political campaigning on the street with the mayor of the city of Linden, New Jersey. He asked me to come out and campaign with him, and I haven't done that kind of campaigning. The lady was saying, you're very adept at this. I said, well, I've been doing this since I was about 17 years old. I got first baptized in the civil rights movement, campaigning door-to-door, and, of course, in the Nation of Islam, door-to-door. So I said, I'm experienced. And we're with a group of people who really just over-talked. They weren't experienced in what to pitch. I didn't even know the candidate. I was only running, they were running the slate, so I was supporting the slate. But I think one of the things that I've noticed out there is talking to people who are really searching for something. And, of course, I introduced myself as Imam Alfred. Some knew what it meant, some didn't. Well, they were very intrigued that I was out campaigning. Actually, I was campaigning for a Caucasian. What do you make of the American people at this point? Let's not talk about any particular candidates, but just the general state of the American mind. And I'm going to lead you into another discussion later. This is kind of a setup question.
I think, as a general rule, of course, there's exception, maybe many exceptions, but as a general rule, the American people are confused. And even though you just got to talking about finish talking about mundane secular activity, very hardcore politicking. I think the poetic language of Bible when it says that in a certain period of time, Jesus would return on the clouds, and Imam Muhammad, the blessed Imam, suggested that, those clouds meant metaphorically that the people's minds would be in a state of confusion, not just spiritual confusion, but holistic confusion, confused about everything. I think that's the state of the American people, African American and Caucasians, by the way, and others.
I think you're right. I think the American people are really in the clouds. And I think I was talking with a guy. I said, who did you? He asked me, he said, in my town, some people know me as Imam. Some even call me Reb. They don't know what else to call me. But I'm known by most of the people in this town, I guess about 100,000 people. And they asked me a lot of my opinions. So they asked me, who did I vote for? Who was I going to vote for? And I told him, he told me who he's going to vote for. And interestingly enough, I asked him, who did you vote in the last election for? So he voted for President Obama. What explains this great swing from persons who have voted for the President of the United States to President Barack Hussein Obama to now being voted for Mr. Trump of the Trump Organization?
Well, I think that's very easy. A masterful use of the late Edward Bernays' principles of public relations to shape public opinion. The media, following the law of repetition, has beaten the drum as if President Obama has been such a favor. People being subconsciously inclined to accept the worst in terms of the governance of Ham. For instance, Trump told the people the other day that President Obama is incompetent in a very, very, very nasty way, which was not referring to Obama. It was a way of saying Ham or black folks don't have the competence to govern. So I think this person has been basically a victim of a repetitive narrative that somehow the country has gone off the rail. But there's no objective indicators socially, economically, or any other variable to substantiate that, even foreign policy. These people getting ready to run ISIS out of Mosul in Iraq. So there's just no support for this dark narrative that a lot of these folk. I noticed, though, that in both instances, he's over a male. So it may be that he may have some of that old stuff in him, too.
Would you explain?
I mean, let's face it. We live in a world that has advocated for years that women shouldn't hold certain positions and be in certain positions of responsibility. That idea exists in the souls of African American males, Caucasian males, Asian American males, you name it. Now, that idea is not necessarily consistent with the picture, only in the sense that a woman cannot be an imam or a prophet, but a woman can be Maryam, a woman can be Aisha, a great Muslim scholar that got more knowledge about the deen than many imams.
What do you think of these Caucasian women who now coming out with signs and grab their, I can't use it on the air, with Mr. Trump? What's going on with that? Is this all racism or is this just something else?
Well, Trump could not have thrived in anything other than a morally corrupt and decadent environment. 20, 30 years ago, when the moral fiber of the Caucasian people was stronger, Trump wouldn't have had the time of day. Even though those people then would have been racist. But it was their moral judgment on other things that would have precluded them from being able to embrace Trump. There's been a major decadence and corruption to beset America in the last 2-3 decades. And individual moral decadence impacts social judgment. A lot of people don't understand that, but when we make our when we call a don, we refer to individual aspects of the human being, and then we flip to the other side and we talk about the group. So that's to suggest it's the same neck. It's just that we turn the neck or head a different way. So if there's individual decadence in a big way, then there's no way those people can be strong in terms of moral conscientious judgment and decision making. It's absolutely impossible.
What do you make of the implosion of the Trump's campaign?
Well, on a just raw political level, there's been an accumulation of things that's been weighing at the American mind and soul. I would even venture to say common sense. But that Billy Bush tape, and I could go deep into that tape incident, because every Republican president since Richard Nixon somehow is brought up in that incident, and that speaks volume. But that Billy Bush tape, in my opinion, is the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. But there's been an accumulation, and Trump has withstood the negative impact politically of that accumulation. But now, I think, and when he that was strike one, the Billy Bush tape. Strike two was the denial in the Anderson Cooper interview in the Sunday night debate that he ever actually executed any of those verbal statements that he made in the Billy Bush tape. And the third strike is now 9 women coming forward in the politically inept manner in which Trump is handling this situation, the way he constantly brings it up at his rallies, pouring more and more gasoline on the fire, and every time he does that, he'll come another complainant. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see one a day until election day. You talking about one a day vitamin? You may see one of these people coming forward until election day. I'm not saying that's the case, but it would not surprise me.
Well, let me ask you this. How do you now see the – let's first talk about the Senate race, United States Senate is, and what y'all call the down vote. I don't know the terminology.
Down ballot races.
Huh?
The down ballot races.
Down ballot races. All right. Talk your talk. Hey, I just think 50 years ago, an African American Very few of us would know that kind of language, but it's good. And in our community of Imam, the Muslim community in America, we wouldn't even been talking that 50 years. So praises be to Allah, that is praise be to God, the creator of everything and over and above creation, that we are now at the table. We sit, well, we're not at the table yet, but we certainly are in the anteroom waiting to sit at the table. Discuss with us first the United States Senate race, and I'll come back and ask you another question.
Let me say this. The professionals on a general basis are suggesting that the Democrats have a 53% chance of retaking the Senate. While that's better than being on the opposite end of that 47%, it's still not a great margin. But before Trump began to implode, these same experts were saying that the Republicans had come back and that the Democrats more than likely would not retake the Senate. Now they're talking about certain private polls that can be distinguished from public polls. Private polls are polls that the campaigns themselves take, Democratic and Republican strategists. They invest more money, more time, more skill, and more science, and they tend to be accurate. And there is, you know, I have to go beyond a poll or snapshot in time and look at the trends. And the Republican politicals, strategists, and operatives, they thinking they're picking up a trend where the Senate may be gone. And believe it or not, a slim possibility of a collapse of the House. That's why Speaker Ryan earlier this week made a conference call and backed away from Trump and suggested to his members that every man for himself. Do what you have to do. If you have to distance yourself from Trump, if you have to run away from Trump, if you have to embrace Trump, do what you have to do, every man for himself, because he knows they need to try to make sure they keep control of the House. So now they're talking about the possibility of a collapse in the House. I doubt if that happened, but that tells you what kind of implosion that's going on and how the trend, how the race is trending. But let me add this. I've been around a long time. Politically, I saw a guy that was a county commission. He got 49% of the vote in the first election. A lady trailed him badly in the runoff. And my position that I had never seen an incumbent lose a runoff election with a novice that was that far behind in percentage. But lo and behold, this lady came back and took that seat. What's the moral of that story? Look, regardless of how the trend looking, how the political lens, what they're reflecting in politics, brother, ma'am, is not over until it's over.
Yes, that's right. And we don't know what could come up before Election Day. But if the trends in what I'm reading of the private polling, it doesn't look very good for Mr. Trump. It doesn't look very good for the Republican Party.
That's right.
At all. I think the Speaker
that's
is
right. And this later, see, there's two things on the line. The vote. That does not look good. But more important, devotion is on the line. What do I mean by that? The party is splintering and fracturing. And when the dust clears from this thing, there's going to be a drastic decrease in the devotion of many Republicans to the Republican Party. They may not recover from this big-time implosion. But as President Obama said the other day, I think in either Columbus or Cleveland, they brought it upon themselves. It's not just Donald Trump. They have been practicing a brand of politics in the last 8 years that laid the foundation for one like Trump to come in and exploit. And, hey, I studied a fellow. He's very manipulative, and he's a master at exploiting a situation. But he didn't create the situation. He didn't bring about the situation. The Republican Party did it. And now they may have to reap the whirlwind, Brother Emanuel. Why? Because Mr. Trump is saying, hey, this election is not going to be legitimate. So if Crooked Hillary wins, the system is rigged, meaning don't put full faith, confidence, and credit in our democratic order, which means 35 to 40% of the American population is going to be up under the thumb of Donald Trump behind after this election. I've seen two or three Caucasian females actually use the word revolution and uprising if Trump don't win. Recently, three members of a Caucasian male-dominating group called the Crusaders was arrested out in Kansas. They had a plan after the election to actually start the uprising by blowing up a masjid, Somali masjid in Kansas. And they had the ammunition, the goods and materials to do big damage. And they say 250 Somalians attend that masjid. So there's going to be big fallout from this election. And this is why I resented Trump from the beginning, because I could tell that he would manipulate his followers and not want to go along with the democratic decision-making process in this particular election.
Yes. What do you think the African-American community should be doing?
They should be thanking God for sparing them from the chastisement of Trumpism while we are sleeping. If we had never been sleeping as an ethnicity, if we had been on the case, been vigilant, been alert, listening to the imam, watching as well as praying over these years, remaining super gas blast strong, super agitating strong, to get the corruption and dirt out of American democracy. It's no way Republicans could have played these games and Trump wouldn't have had a chance. But we went to sleep in the nest here. We went to sleep in the church. We went to sleep in the community. Almost a super rip band wrinkle syndrome. And but by the grace of Allah, turning this thing back, we have got caught up, Brother Imam, because we are just as sleep as we can be.
Let me ask you this. What
as a general rule, exceptions, as I said earlier.
What explains the sleep syndrome, the ambient-like approach of the Muslim Muslim leadership, well, I would say the propofol dosage that the Muslim leadership has put in the people. And why have the people chosen to drink the Kool-Aid?
Well, I would say drink the wine.
Yes,
the
sir.
Wine. It's so esoteric, mystical, non-pragmatic. The water don't supposed to flow above the earth. The man said that water flow underneath the earth. Meaning that we don't get caught all up in our daily life in ritualism, mysticism, and Holy Ghostism. A kind of desert Holy Ghostism. Not the ruined kind of Holy Ghostism, but a crazy, bold-blading Holy Ghostism. And so that wine, I remember when I was used to be a young boy, I could drink a little schoolboy scotch. It would get me bent. A little chump oil, it would get me bent. But that wine, that schoolboy scotch, would put me to sleep every time. Now, as for the general African American community, we have gotten immune to that, some of that old church-based wine. But we violated the clear instruction of our great leader and mastermind, James Weldon Johnson, in his lyrics in our Negro National Anthem. He told us not to get drunk with the wine of the world. He warned us not to get drunk, Brother Imam, with the wine of the world. We get up and sing that song and just as drunk as we can be with the wine of the world. And so the wine of the world that has put most of our African-American Christian brothers to sleep.
So now you're saying that the masjid has become the ice house. We used to accuse the church of being the ice house. So you're telling me that the masjid is now the ice house.
You know, when I was a little boy, we used to make Kool-Aid and freeze it and suck on it. I would even say Kool-Aid. I say frozen wine if you can freeze it. So we don't even have the water to make the ice with. We're not coming with no water. There's nothing but wine. As a matter of fact, we don't even make with water. We make with milk. And the prophet said, look, give me the milk. Don't give me that wine. And these old egghead, big-headed scientists running around trying to dazzle folk with a language. They gave the people the wine in derogation of the instructions of the prophet. The good common sense principles that structure this deen. The calcium in the milk is in the bone. If we had just stuck with the milk, we'd be a lot further down the road. But these brothers selected the wine, and our people are just gurgling that wine down.
Brother Imam, do you think they were put on post? Let me just ask you this question. In one of the major cities in these United States, every imam has come out of prison and a convicted felon. Can you give an explanation for that?
I don't know whether that could be factually confirmed, but I mean, if you do have a saturation of brothers that was felons or come out of prison, that may make them vulnerable, but coming from a legal and a political perspective, where I have to advocate sometimes that ex-felons should be allowed to vote, I don't necessarily want to draw any big conclusion. Now, if you want to do it, then I'm certainly open to whatever argument you make on that.
I just find it curious that in a major city, every leader is a convicted felon. I have nothing against felons. I had a few of them in my family. And when a man does his time, fine. But I find it very curious to have all felons, especially when the leader has said that needs to be to get rid of these prison imams over our people. What do you think Imam Muhammad meant when he said we need to get these prison imams waiting over our people?
Well, he could have meant several things, but that certainly is a easy plant, for one thing. Not saying that the brothers are plants, but you do that kind of status can facilitate deals, instructions from people who want to sabotage the mission of the imam, the way they tried to sabotage the mission of the Nation of Islam. Then you have the extreme, what I call Moses complex. Moses killed a man. He was able to get back in his form. But the imam said, Prophet Muhammad and men like themselves, they never violate the moral cloak. And so they don't have to go through a transformation of their sins, implying that it's very difficult for a brother to be like Moses. Most of us are not going to truly change. Those who were best before Al-Islam, according to the prophet, would be best afterwards, according to the prophet. So we can act like we change. We can struggle to modify. But when we get a deeply oriented, erroneous character, it's very difficult to change. And that's why I think the man. Now, you can come in the masjid and struggle to change, but why should you be in the head when you're trying to go through that big struggle to uproot all these criminal tendencies? That may have been what the man was talking about. I'm speculating. I don't have any
first-hand documentary evidence
on that.
The reason I asked, I hate to put you in the category with your fellow Georgian and fellow lawyer, Mr. J.B. Stoner. But Mr. Stoner is quoted as saying in a letter to the Honorable Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad, repent of your Mohammedanism, he says, in a letter and message to the black man.
Now,
and then in another response to the Honorable Muhammad, Mr. Stoner of Stone Mountain, Georgia, wrote the Honorable Muhammad and said, oh, shucks, we know how to deal with the nigger Muslims. Flood them with nigger pimps and nigger hustlers. And by maybe 1964, I remember studying the Nation of Islam, and only two ministers of the Honorable Muhammad's leadership, ministers, had been to prison. I'm not talking about those who went for conscience objection, but only two had been convicted criminals. One was Minister Malcolm Shabazz, and the other was Minister James Shabazz. Everybody else had come from basically Christian backgrounds, but they were not from jail. By the 1980s, many of the major messiahs either had prison imams or had imams working in the prison. So I'm wondering if Mr. Stoner may have been right. Was he prophesizing or was he planning, conspiracizing? What do you think?
I had a personal experience with Mr. J.B. Stoner at the University of Georgia in Athens. And I will say that he says what he means and means what he says. Now, he presented and made a speech at the University of Georgia. And I led a group of brothers. He didn't have security guard. He had the audacity to actually speak at a place and walk to his car without any security whatsoever.
He was pretty damn bold to use the terminology.
Yeah, he was. And so We didn't have any weapons or anything, but we began to follow him and to heckle him and to talk trash behind him. All of a sudden, he turned around, kind of braced his briefcase, and said, "I'm not like those others. I'll kill y'all." What are you saying, brother?
Well, you in other words, you're an eyewitness. You're not hearing, this is not hearsay testimony about his capacity for violence and current his work. In other words, you didn't find Mr. Stoner to be very empty.
No, sir. And the thing, I did, and he was dead serious. And I had personally a style about me at the time that exemplified unmitigated boldness. But I was a reasonable man, a rational man. But not just me, the other brothers with me. We could tell that he meant business, and we concluded the way he hit that briefcase that he probably had a weapon in there. And that may be why he didn't have any security, because he probably felt if I got my heat, I can protect myself walking on the University of Georgia campus. But so Stoner was a serious man. So if he wrote that, he meant it. That's my point.
Okay. Well, that's what he said. And I tell you something. There was one leader, the first week that Muhammad came in office, he's dead now, I won't name him. If they press me, I will name him. But Imam Muhammad told him, said, "You're nothing but a black pimp. Get out of my office." He was one of the few ministers that he didn't even keep with him. That's how horrible this person was. But Imam gave most of these leaders an opportunity to repent. He said he knew some of them had come from the Klan. Now, you know, we had some connections with the Klan. I don't want to go into that here. So I don't think Mr. Stoner's words were empty at all. I know he did. I know that certainly. You know, let me tell you something that's very interesting happened to me this weekend. Yes, this week I thought it was quite interesting. I was discussing Brother Minister Malcolm, and suddenly a man drew interest and said, "My father knew Minister Malcolm." I said, "Who might that have been?" Because I knew all the people that was around Minister Malcolm, post-Nation of Islam, and in the Nation of Islam. And he told me who his father was. And his father turned out to be Gene Roberts, the boss police officer that accompanied Malcolm, that had infiltrated Malcolm's organization. So I don't think, and I'm setting up for another question. That turned out to be his father. His name was Roberts. He was his father. I think the intelligence department and the bad sinister forces in America was more disturbed by Imam Muhammad than they were by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And if that is the case, and what Mr. Hoover had to say, why do you think they were more disturbed by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who taught that the white man was the devil and America was falling, and Imam Muhammad, who taught New World Patriotism, and taught a new Islam and taught self-improvement? Why is that, took the emphasis off race and put the emphasis on humanity? Why do you think that intelligence forces and people of Mr. Stoner's ilk were more disturbed? I think Mr. Hoover was a very demented person. And it sounds
like... Yeah, well, I would like to deal with that in the context of Mr. Hoover and those who supported his policy. I would not necessarily extend that throughout the length of the mission of the man once Hoover died, passed away, what have you, and all his imps left the scene. But I read out of a book called A Messenger by Carl Evans one day on your show when I first started coming on. And there was an assessment by the intelligence forces that the man to really be concerned about is Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad. Now, this is a very, very, and the analysis was that he knew more about the religion and that they had observed him not to have the character to be corrupted by money. That's not their language. They said about all the children, he's the most spiritually devoted, and he's demonstrated that he couldn't be corrupted by money. Now, but let's take that further beyond those forces. The Imam said he gave a lecture at William College, somewhere up in New England, I think it is.
In Massachusetts.
And he said after that lecture, one of the professors came up to him and issued a bail threat. He said, "You know what happened to Prometheus when he brought the fire down to mankind." And one of the problems they had with the Imam is that they didn't want him to share the heavenly fire with the masses of people. Another way we can see it is with the president. They have been afraid that I'm talking about these forces now, not the intelligence forces, but these forces that had a deep fear of Imam Muhammad. That the president somehow would become influenced, had been influenced by the Imam, and so consequently, it was some kind of surreptitious or secret Muslim. Not just a Muslim from on the Eastern style. They wouldn't have worried about that as long as he was in secret. But they didn't want an African-American of that kind of power, these forces, directly acknowledging and embracing what the Imam taught. So they've always been afraid of that. So they've been constantly throwing out this Muslim thing around him. And a lot of what you see happening around him is not that he's just African-American. It's a fear that somehow, either now or after he leave office, he may embrace openly and fully the teachings of Imam Muhammad. And for those people who do not want to see the heavenly fire brought to the masses in their mind, that would be a disaster. Now, that may be a level of paranoia. I doubt very seriously if the president of these United States is considering anything like that. But you never know. There's a possibility, because they do know that there was some kind of distant interaction and relationship between the president and Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad. Very distant.
I will go on the record and tell you, and I'm not going to go into my.
I hope you tell the audience, too, because they need to know.
I will tell the audience. I mean to tell the audience. When Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad II was invited to the White House after much consternation of other persons around the President of the United States and a lot of conspirators inside of our community's leadership who wanted to block him, Imam Waruthuddin Muhammad II said, "I've always thought of myself as Little Wallace." The President of the United States' response was, "You shouldn't." He said, "I am very familiar. Your father and I were very close." This is the president's words. I know it's on the record, so everything in the White House is recorded, so he didn't hide it. "We're very close. I think I know for a fact that Imam Muhammad influenced the president, because for one reason, he's the first person to make the president feel whole. Imagine being an African, your father being an African, no real connections in America, and your mother being a Caucasian from Kansas, how he must have felt. And when he went on the south side of Chicago and met Imam Muhammad, I'm talking way before he was President Obama. He was nobody at that time. He was just a regular citizen working, I believe, for IPCO, the organization headed by Saul Alinsky, Interfaith Council for Organization, and organized communities that have been decimated by deindustrialization. This man has been, and he, one of the people that he'd spent a long time with was Imam Waqidi Muhammad. This is on the record. That's why I go on the record. So I'm not speculating, and I'm not giving a lot more details either.
I understand, believe me, the President of the United States has taken enough flack, and I know you're a very wise brother, and I try to have a little wisdom, so we don't want to say too much for him to have to deal with any more flack on this conversation. Now, why is this question important that you brought up, Brother Imam? The masses of people of all races are conditioned from the womb to the tomb to think that the leader that's violent and willing to strike back, either physically or verbally, against the enemy is the number one type leader, the most potent leader that the enemy fears. So the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, black folks out there, the masses, seeing him calling the white man the devil, Elijah bad, that's very impressive. Then his disciple come along, late Malcolm X, and he running all that pirate talk. Now, hey, that's a bad, you know what? But that's based upon a conditioning that the true enemies of mankind and the race want them to have. They don't want them to suspect that there's another type leader who we really fear. And that's the leader. How do we know what leader is that? The Pharaoh didn't fear Moses when he killed a man and was getting ready to organize through Hebrew solidarity a physically violent movement. A guy came to him, and I'm just talking a little local language, and told him that the Pharaoh, that the forces of the government was organizing against him the way they organized against the Panthers and the nations in the 60s. And what did Moses do? Moses left. Moses beat a retreat. So Pharaoh wasn't afraid of Moses on that level of development. But the average mass person, like we did in the 60s, in the 50s and the 60s, saw the Honorable Elijah Muhammad out there doing his thing and the Muslim doing their thing. We thought that was powerful. Well, that's based upon ignorance. The big forces that run this thing don't worry about us doing nothing to them physically, militarily, and violently. Why, they could handle that with the snap of a finger. But look what Moses had to do. He went and studied high spiritual sciences away from the religious tradition of Egypt. But even that was not enough to liberate the people. Now, he had to make another step. He had to go up to receive the burning brand of revelation. And then when he received the burning brand of revelation, Pharaoh killed a man, but Pharaoh would arrest him. Why would he arrest him? Because he fit. Moses and they had him right there in the camp. They could have very easily arrested him. And Pharaoh threw in his face that you killed a man. Why didn't they arrest Moses? Because they were afraid of Moses. They were afraid of Aaron. And when Moses threw his rod, they really became intimidated, especially those in his court that had the supreme knowledge of Egypt. One of them saw it and converted on the spot to what Moses was saying. Others converted also. We have a surah in the Quran that's dedicated to that one that converted on the spot and challenged that. But the ignorant masses, they think the man that talked militant talk, yeah, we're afraid of the enemy. To see one come along and talk back and talk strong, yes, that's impressive. I wouldn't call it wolf kicking. Instead of wolf kicking, those men were serious and outraged that did that. But they were not what the Pharaoh feared, ultimately. They never did want a man to go up into heaven and get the great wisdom that would bring Elijah's instructions true. You'll never become equal to the white man until you get equal or superior knowledge. They knew that Imam Muhammad had gotten superior knowledge. Not even, can I prove it? This movie Fine and Forrester, Hollywood put it out. And they had a figure in there by the name of Jamal Wallace. Sean Connery was in the movie, and this little fella Jamal Wallace was out there on the court playing ball with the other players in the community. But he knew this guy was in the tower, so he had the nerve to try to go up there. The rest of them were afraid. The rest of the leaders in our community, they were afraid to try to take that journey to heaven, to take that ascension. They wanted to stay down on earth, sell a few wolf kickers, and as Jesse said, shake the fruit. He said, I'm a tree shaker, not a jelly maker. And the movie showed it. So they still lying there while Jamal Wallace went all the way up there where Sean Connery was, where all the books was, and all the writings were. All the books were and all the writings. Hollywood. Now, any student of the language of Arabia, they would have to ask the question, what does Jamal mean? I'm sure you're familiar with the rule of Jamal. And that's what they were saying, not about the man physically, but that heavenly knowledge that God had blessed them with. They were afraid. Even had a girl in the movie named Clara, the name of Imam Mama. Name of the movie is Fine and Forrest. You still there?
I'm here, my dear brother. I'm here. I'm listening. I heard you. Now, let me ask you this. Connect that with Imam Muhammad's statement in the late 50s, maybe early 60s, when he said he would leave the Nation of Islam and he would remain a Muslim, but his leader would be Dr. Martin Luther King, and both men taught a universalism. What do you make of the fact that Dr. King, and in the late years after we had gotten more sober, Imam Muhammad said the real leader of our people was not Dawood Muhammad. I've just got to be honest with y'all people. But the real leader of our people was Dr. Martin Luther King. We hadn't had a leader since. What do you say about that? Can you make a comment on that and connect the to our discussion that we have had.
Yes, I certainly can. Dr. King, people don't know this because he grew up in Atlanta, but his paternal, his maternal ancestral roots are out of Greene County, Georgia. His grandfather, Adam Daniel Williams, was out of Greene County, Georgia. His daddy, old man Willis King, was brought up in a white church. They let him become a minister, but they caught him stealing, and they busted him. I'm talking about old man Willis King, Adam Daniel King daddy. Williams. Adam Daniel Williams had a sister who was a twin named Eve. So you see that his daddy, Willis Williams, knew scripture, so he named his son Adam and his daughter Eve. Anyway, so what is that? That's a sign that there was genetically contained in Dr. King very DNA, a strong pattern based upon the original nature of Adam. That's why he had that moral conscience that he demonstrated. That's how he had the human sensitivities that he demonstrated. That's how he had the human sensibilities that he demonstrated. Okay? Because he was a sign of that Adam, that original Adam. And he demonstrated that more so probably than any leader in our history. Adam Clayton Powell had it in his early development, but the last part of his name, the Powell, or the Powell, corrupted that Adam a little bit. And he lost it. But if you study him early in his career, he was very dedicated and conscientious. He had Adam and Clay in his name. But Dr. King had that. But what did he tell us? Said, my Adamic nature is telling me that the law of justice is going to kick in, ultimate justice, but I'm not going to be around to see it. It's not my role. Now, that destiny is the promised land, and the promised land is not a physical place. It's a place of ultimate understanding. So what comes after Adam that gives you that ultimate understanding? According to the Book of Revealed Cosmic Science, God acknowledged that Adam is not going to be able to deal with the forces of this world. But he said to the diabolic one that I'm going to bring one, and I'm just saying that to make it consistent with biblical language, that's going to get mankind to the promised land. And when I believe in him, and when I reveal the book to him, then you bow down. So the man making that statement was acknowledging the excellence of Adam. But he knew that Dr. King was not a master of the book that was sent to Muhammad to make these diabolic forces bow down. And even in Imam's family circle, eventually one came with the name of Adam, one of his grandchildren. So the Imam had that Adam in his nature strong. That's why he could recognize it and appreciate it in Dr. King. And it's that Adamic nature in him that interacted with Quran, that put him in a position to receive the promised land understanding. The man said, home is understanding of the mind. And so these enemies of the race, they understood that. And so they were afraid of the man because they knew he had been blessed with that burning brand out of Quran. Now, in their mythology, they don't call it a burning brand. They just said Prometheus got the fire. But in the book, Musa told the people, look, I perceive a power. Some, you know what, you know it better than me that can roam us. Maybe I can find some information there or something. You know, I think I'm quoting it halfway right.
Sir.
Yeah, so that's exactly what happened. The Book of Revealed Cosmic Science, give it in straight language. Their mythology, give it in another language. Prometheus goes to heaven and steals the heavenly fire. This fellow Williams understood the knowledge of the elite, the heavenly light of the elite. He knew Imam had it, and he threatened him. He said, what was the punishment for Prometheus? The punishment was that they chained him to a rock, which meant, just like Yusuf in Quran, they put him in a state of immobility. Yusuf was in prison, Prometheus chained to a rock. Not that they couldn't physically travel, but we're going to have a scheme to keep your knowledge from circulating in the culture. Now, they saw the Imam stuff among the elite. They passed it around. But they did everything they could to hide him from the masses in America. The liver is the organ of assimilation. In their mythology, it means culture. And they say it's ruled by the planet Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system. That's what they say. So when they ate out his liver, that meant that they didn't want the Imam to influence the culture. And you know and I know, the Imam said, really, America hadn't had a culture. We're here to bring the first culture. But they don't want that to happen, so they had the vultures to eat out his liver.
Well, I tell you something. You owned to something, but you probably remember when Imam Muhammad was on Walter Cronkite's program, the CBS Evening News, interviewed by Randy Daniels, and Imam Muhammad said, this is June 1975, that at this time we were still called the Lost Found Nation of Islam. Maybe he changed it to the World Community of Islam in the West. He said that we would offer an alternative culture. And I think that forces inside and outside of the community conspire to keep the Imam. I remember as a young minister being told that the Supreme Minister didn't want us to teach anybody else. We were the basic, just teach ourselves. So they did, this was passed from.
No, they were chaining them to the rock, Brother Imam.
Sir?
That's chaining them to the rock, a plot to keep them from circulating.
That's right. I mean, I'm telling you, I actually had leaders. I was in the leadership at the time. And I had big, experienced leaders who used to be great fishermen of men, as they called it. And used to insist that you sold papers, you did all you tried to. How many dead did you bring? And I later on, these same people were telling me not to bring the dead. Supreme Minister don't want you doing that, brother. Supreme Minister don't want you to. And I knew this was a goddamn lie. So over a 5-year period of time, they had decreased the members from inviting people even to hurt Imam Muhammad. And Imam Muhammad was left just with his own following, never to expand into the culture, basically creating this thing into a personality cult. I'm not saying that that's what happened, because most of the people, even today, they're just drunk on another tape. I had a brother the other day, they asked me for a tape of Imam Muhammad from 70-something. I said, brother, I'm not listening to history. I'm too busy making history.
Well, the thing about it,
challenge today is for us to get back in these streets.
got it, brother. Ma'am, let me, don't you tell me all the time when you meet with these African Americans in the out of community, some of them in position of status, you always come back and tell me that they don't know the Imam, Brother Yusuf. Brother Imam, that's what you're doing. You said they don't know the Imam. So now look, I've gone to big conventions with the Imam, thousands of folk there. If we were out propagating like we did under the nation, like was done under the Nation of Islam, how could it possibly be that these people you talking to don't know very much about the Imam?
Because I'm going to tell you why. This is directly connected to what Imam Muhammad said in 19. Well, I ain't going to give the year because these freaks, they always like years and time. But anyway, he was talking about the covenant. I know for a fact that the Imam said, he said, I'm here, I'm glad to meet with you all. He said, this is no dawah meeting, I want you to know that. He said, because if you were doing dawah, we couldn't even get in this place. Lines would be on the outside. So we never did promote the Imam to the people. We never did. I've been advocating for the last 8 years that we get out in the streets with Imam Muhammad's DVDs and CDs, just like the Jehovah's Witnesses are doing, just like the Mormons are doing. The only two people that today is moving on the streets is the Witnesses and the Mormons. Nobody else. Don't kid yourself. Farrakhan ain't moving. His people ain't moving on the street. We have actually caused a blood clot in our community. Would you care to comment on that?
Well, all life begins in water. And death begins in water, too, when it becomes stagnated. There was a systematic collective effort to promote large-scale stagnation in the community. Promote stagnation. How was it done? Through a subtle selling and not so subtle selling of ritualism. Of ritualism. You know, I had a book that was written by somebody from the East, West, America, what have you, about Al-Islam, the teachings of Islam. You go in there and they get the teaching. They start you off with prayer. I mean, with the kalima. Then they go to prayer. Then they go to fasting. And you know the thing. And then they throw a little bit more out about something else. But basically, it's a breakdown of the rituals. That's not the core of Al-Islam. Can I prove it? When the man came to the prophet and wanted to know one thing, the Imam said he had a little devilism in him, going to try to test the prophet. Wanted the prophet to tell him something that was wise or something profound. And the prophet said, say you believe in forever after be upright. He didn't say go make Hajj and forever after be upright. He didn't say go and fast and forever after be upright. Yeah, but that's part of being upright. If it is, then what about those people who can't pass? What about those people who can't make the Hajj? If they literally can't make the Hajj, and if they can't pass, but that's part of the requirement of forever after being upright, then how can old people forever have to be upright? I think in Surah 2, the Quran lays out basically the criteria for being upright.
That's right.
And it says it's not right that you upright that you engage in ritual. It doesn't say ritual, turn your face, I think, to east or west. If I'm wrong, correct me. So
right.
The So when they give us the so-called teachings of Islam, they're giving us the wrong focus. That imam dealt with that kind of stuff because he didn't want us to be ignorant of these rituals improperly used or necessary in our deen. But if you study the imam generally, he did not teach a whole lot on ritualism. He gave us the understanding we need to live an upright life. That's what he did. All these tape these brother want to talk about, he may have done a tape on prayer, but the overwhelming majority of his messages did not even deal with any rituals. But he was steady teaching his religion. But people have been conditioned
when he
Eastern style.
Religion.
Huh?
Yes, sir. And I said, what
people have been conditioned Eastern style to think that the way they present the religion is the religion, and they thought the imam was engaging in bitter innovation or something.
That's right. That's right. And I tell you another thing. Every ritual Imam Muhammad taught, it had meaning for resurrected society. None of it was empty of the conditions of people. There's not one ritual that you can ever hear Imam Muhammad explain that wouldn't raise the dead and put people to life. And now you can see why Stoner and others were not worried about Dawud like Muhammad. They were worried that Imam Muhammad would create the same circumstances or better than what happened with our ancient foreparents there in Andalusia, that was now known as Spain and Portugal. A world
right.
of peace and tranquility that the Jewish people said had that golden era. Maimonides had such a great time feasting from the Quran. And others had brought the Greek classic back. So they know that this same thing will happen in America.
Well,
they
know
that. That's the threat. That's the Prometheus bringing the fire from the heavens.
And
I
you're
said
right.
the bird is a global man
and
the electric
cargo
I given that we are going to freely sprinkle the whole Western Hemisphere with this light from heaven. It's not going to come from the East. They're dead. They will never rise again. America, the American Western people, will never rise again. The only way that America will rise again is through us. And I think the most impressive thing we can do is let our people know that the most important people on the face of the planet Earth are those who are us, who are sincere and believe in that. I just got to make an announcement again. We're going to have a public address called Taking Back Our Community. It's going to be held in London. Brother Imam, we're trying to catch up with y'all down in that community development class.
Well, it's so needed. And see, you study this little system. They knew when Elijah came on the scene, when John came on the scene, that there would be one coming after him. And they wanted that. They wanted to get an even better understanding of the heavens. They wanted to get an even better understanding, but they, as the book say, they tried to steal it by expanding their consciousness, not based upon Taqwa consciousness, but another kind of consciousness, and they used a quick way of trying to get there. Through psychedelics. They even understood Quran, and one of them named a group called the Doors. And based upon what one of their wise men, Blake, said, that when the doors are open to perception, then one can see things from a level of infinity. So they were racing, trying to open up the doors of heaven, because Quran said one day the heavens would be open as if there were doors, as if there were doors. But what they didn't understand, you have to get there not through a quick hit, but through a long, struggle like the African-American soul went through, and the nature is refined, and the nature is purified. And after 300-400 years, one rises up from that womb, not with just the nature of Nature Turner, Nat, N-A-T, Nat Turner, that's nature. Okay, not just with that nature to resist oppression. And I see that people all are happy at the movie to find out that some of us resisted oppression. That was good. That meant we were alive in our nature. But the nature evolved since that time. Well, it was ready to meet the Quran. And that what happened after 300-400 years. The African American couldn't go and take no psychedelic acid to expand our consciousness. The struggle, the suffering, the oppression. Suffering was our companion. And this suffering, it made a diamond in the soul. And after natural, Allah created everything gradually, growing naturally. So it appeared a natural time. One from amongst us had the nature that was ready to receive the book. And that's what happened. But they were trying to get it, taking all those psychedelics in the 60s. They weren't just trying to get high, Timothy Leary and all old folk. Now, they were trying to mess up the masses, but they themselves were like that gin trying to steal a peak in heaven. But they wanted to do it artificially. They didn't want to do it naturally through a divinely crafted evolution that happened with the African-American from the time we were in that little canyon over there off the coast of the Atlantic, through the Mill Passage, through slavery, through Jim Crowism. Allah was refining the soul, refining the nature, getting ready for it to meet the book that will open up the heavens and earth, open up the doors of heaven.
Betty, ma'am, I'm making a prediction. And I'm going to see whether I'm crazy. If I'm crazy, I hope you as an attorney will make sure that I get a guardian ad litem to get me to a mental hospital. But if I'm right, I hope you will urge the audience to join me. I am predicting that when we do a real call, I don't like to use foreign language, dawah, when we expand Imam Muhammad's teachings to the public, and when we have a new student nonviolent committee, the revival of student, and we see the real new earth team and the blight of rest to end the street poison, I'm predicting that in Alabama, I'm predicting that in Georgia, I'm predicting that they will come to the masjid and knock on the door and say, do y'all have anybody ready to run for office? I'm predicting, now I hope I didn't eat any bean pie today, so I don't have any excuse. I'm predicting that what we saw in the Christian Science Monitor that was reprinted in the Muslim Journal is going to happen soon and very soon. Am I crazy? Am I insane? Or am I on to something?
I think you own is something. That's, as the saying goes, sound like to me you got correct dream. you're not prophesying. You got correct dream.
I just want to know whether I needed a
you got
heater.
Correct dream. You got correct vision. Yes, sir.
This is what I believe. I believe when the message is clear, I told people that I believe when they see 50,000 African-American Muslims walking down the street, Fifth Avenue, I don't want it up in Harlem, with marching bands for New World Patriotism Day and this broadcast. You got to get hundreds of thousands before people were paying attention to you. Big, huge meetings. Imam Muhammad told us the importance of big meetings. Why then do we have people among our community still promote small meetings? No,
I don't know, but brother, ma'am, look, you know what I'm doing this month, but I'm going to say this. You remember when Sister Kiara, I think is her name, was living, and the ma'am had this meeting in Washington, D.C., and when they showed up, he got any bit of support, very few people at the meeting. Well, what happened to the coordinating, organizing efforts of our imam to get people there the way that the imam had requested? What happened with that?
The leaders didn't back him. They made promises to him, and they never showed up with the buses. So that tells me we are going to have a new movement among our people. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, sir. But I would like to say we got new intelligent callers and in order to give a balanced picture. We don't want to think or project the idea that somehow the work of imam is shooting bad. We understand that if you got one soul trying to do something, and if it's rooted in righteousness and truth and justice and freedom and equality, that is, that one soul can help through the grace of God save the life of a whole people. And we got more than one soul in America standing behind what the man brought. So we're in a good situation. I want people to tune in for the first time, really hearing us give a critique of our community and think the work of Allah is in bad shape. No, it's in the best shape it's ever been in.
That's what I said. These are the good days. Now, I don't want to leave anybody with that impression. What I want the people to understand that there's a new sheriff in town, and that is sincere believers coming together. And I see a growing, phenomenal growth. Like I said, I just came back. I know why I'm fired up. I just came back. I wasn't out preaching at Islam. I was a Muslim, going door to door in a predominantly Caucasian neighborhood. And the people treated me with utmost respect. I was with the mayor of this city's sister and his wife, and we went door to door campaigning for candidates. I later on met the candidate. But great reception. I said, I got to go home. Guys, he wanted to come on the radio show, the candidate. So I'm the host of the radio show, but unfortunately I have on the show the former president pro temp of Selma, Alabama, whose name is Yusuf Salam. So I have to interview him. I won't have to be able to interview you. They don't know this is an internet broadcast, but what I'm saying is we got to get back to a massive door-to-door campaign. I don't think people ever think that there's despair. And Allah says, God says to us in his holy book, your guardian Lord has not forsaken you, neither is he displeased, for the future will be better for you than the present. I thank
Brother
you,
ma'am, that's right. And all praise due to God. Let me say this. Hold it now. You know, I told you, and I don't like to publicize this, but I'm engaging in a certain ritual.
Yes, sir.
And it's time for me to go.
Yes, sir.
You feel me?
Yes, sir. So that's what I want you to go. Yes, sir. I was getting ready to let you go right then.
All right. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam. Thank you, dear brother.
You're welcome, my brother. You be blessed.
All right. As-salamu alaykum.